It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back with me on Monday. Coming up, some expert advice on how to make the most of your holiday photo sessions this year. First, according to the Wall Street Journal, consumers are borrowing a little more again. We'll find out what this could mean for our credit habits in America. Lewis Hyman is our guest now. He's an assistant professor at Cornell University and the author of Debtor Nation. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, as we launch into this big shopping weekend and the run-up to Christmas, how are Americans feeling about taking on debt these days?
Americans are very debt-avoidant these days. If you look at the numbers, it's very clear that people are borrowing less than they did certainly during their run-up to the financial crisis, and people are looking for alternatives like layaway.
And I assume that it's because of that recession, everybody's a little gun-shy about new debt?
People are gun-shy, and it's not just the borrowers, it's also the lenders. That if you look at the numbers, you can see that there is just very little money coming out for people to borrow in the way that they had, especially on credit cards.
I thought I'd heard that might be softening up. I mean, in the pre-recession times, the joke was that if you had a pulse, you could get a mortgage and 20 credit cards and a car loan. Then it was, you know, blood from a stone. Things aren't loosening up from the lender's perspective?
They're loosening up a little bit, especially on securitized non-revolving loans, like house loans and things like that, or car loans. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's pretty anemic. The number of dollars increasing is near zero, plus or minus a billion, you know, for the level of the economy that actually is near zero. So thinking about that way, it's pretty substantial how things are not changing.
Well, I can see a good read on that and a bad read. The good read is we aren't going to be getting ourselves in over our heads with easy debt. The bad read is if we can't borrow money as easily, we can't buy stuff and boost the economy in this slow recovery. Where is there some truth on both sides of that?
And there's another truth as well. I think there's truths on both of those sides, but there's another truth that the money is also not being lent into businesses. So that, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if they said, hey, we're not going to lend you money to go shopping today as long as the money were being invested in, you know, new factories or businesses, something that produced jobs. But it's mostly that these banks are just sitting on the money, which doesn't help anybody at all.
What would it take for financial institutions to start lending money again?
Well, I think it's about creating safety and creating incentives, not just to invest in, you know, big projects like green technology or things like that, but even just small businesses. I think the government could do a lot towards creating standards for investing in small businesses, just like they have done with houses. Of course, houses are all of a wide variety of shapes and sizes, but you can create a few different qualities of a house, standards for houses that allow people to lend on them. You know, that someone can buy a mortgage for a house in Texas or Wisconsin and have the money come from New York is a pretty amazing thing.
So a lot of people have always talked about the American dream, often centering around the house. I've heard rumblings lately that the new American dream is to be debt-free or close to. Do you see that kind of big picture change?
I think that would be an amazing shift to have us focus more on our solvency and financial capacity than on things. But I think for a lot of Americans, it's just not possible. I mean, the recovery has largely gone to the top 1%. And, you know, for everybody else who's not part of that, their lives are just as unstable, their paychecks uncertain as ever before. And I think the other American dream isn't just being out of debt, but feeling like you have a good job or even a small business that would provide you enough to live off of.
I want to take a step back from what's going on today. I know you've traced the rise of debt as part of United States culture and capitalism. How did we switch from an era where credit was for the businesses you were talking about? I'll lend you money to build that new factory, or I'll buy a bond in your new business, to debt being something that goes on the consumer side?
Yeah, it's a really big question. It's a long process, and I've written two books about it, but I'll try and summarize it in one sentence. the answer is that it became more profitable to invest in a dollar of consumer credit than a dollar of business investment. And this began to happen in the 1960s, when large corporations like General Electric began to realize they could make more money off of financing the goods that they made than in the manufacturing of goods that they made. This has big ramifications because it's exactly this moment when you begin to see our largest corporations begin to shift their assets out of producing, out of factories, and into finance. And what this does is it produces lots of money for these corporations, but it doesn't produce the good jobs that made it possible to buy those goods, to pay back those goods. And so in this moment from the 70s to now, we have a complete stagnation of American income, and yet our economy keeps growing. And that gap between what we're paid and what we spend is made possible by debt. And so in the post-war period, if the 1% paid the 99% in wages, after 1970, they just lent them money.
I remember a quote somewhere about General Motors, somebody saying, "We used to be an auto company that happened to loan money. Now we're a lending institution that happens to make cars." Is that common for a lot of big American corporations?
That's exactly right. So if you look at the biggest companies like General Motors or General Electric, these companies that we think of as making things, they begin to shift their resources into lending money. And for good reason, that it just becomes more profitable because of increasing automation and globalization and competition. But yet it has very dire ramifications. And so on the one hand, it's understandable why they did it, but it's also from a failure of imagination. So that, we don't have those crazy futuristic kinds of products that we all imagine we would have, partially because that money went into finance and not into manufacturing.
Interesting. So was there a brain drain, too? I hear sometimes the smartest people who used to go into science and engineering now go into the financial industry. Is that something that's stifling American innovation?
Absolutely. That's absolutely stifling American innovation, that all the smartest people go into management consulting and investment banking and things like that when, in the post-war, they would have gone to work at Bell Labs. Of course, Bell Labs, isn't quite the center of things, the hotbed for where smart people go anymore. And it's because there's just big money. I mean, people who are scientists are as rational as the rest of us, and the choice between $60,000 a year or $600,000 a year is a pretty easy choice. But it's had big ramifications, not just for those scientists, but for the economy as a whole, which we need to think about in terms of creating incentives for research and development.
Yeah, what kind of incentive turns that around? You said, if you're making exponentially more money working at a financial outfit on Wall Street, how do you get people back into those more innovative professions?
Well, the easiest way would just be to create tax incentives for large corporations to invest in R&D and to help them focus on long-term development rather than short-term profit. But that's a very hard shift in our era of shareholder value to get people to think about the long-term over the short-term. The short-term always wins out.
Well, I want to talk about something else happening over the weekend now. A lot of people will be using their credit cards, even if it's hard to get new ones. How did we get credit cards? Where did those come from? They're a fairly, in the scope of human history, recent invention.
Sure. Credit cards come out of the late 1950s. There's some sort of many experiments with credit cards before that, but the idea of being able to have a card that you could use anywhere, that you were able to go to any shop and buy anything on, is a very recent phenomena. And it really comes out of the 1960s. And it's real driver is the Bank of America, who is able in California to create a network of both customers and merchants who accept these cards. Before then, credit was very much tied to particular stores and retailers. And that function of offering credit was not something that was done through banks or through larger markets. It was done through particular stores. And so from the 50s, the 60s, it begins to expand. But it really takes off in the 1980s. It takes off in the 1980s as those interest rates pop up in the Volcker years, but they stay up for credit cards. And then with securitization, people are able to offer much more credit than ever before in the 1990s.
And it seems like the technology, the infrastructure, must have made it much easier and faster to use those credit cards. And did that lead to a mushrooming of the use of those?
Absolutely. You can't have widespread credit cards without point-of-sale technology. And so as they're better able to track purchases, or they're better able to generate credit reporting for individuals. Banks are able to extend more and more credit to customers.
So let's look at the long run again. I kind of think of the economy as maybe boom and bust, or you get a bubble where everybody's living a little high on the hog, and then it bursts and it goes down. Are we going to see that cycle again where we have a lot of credit available to us once more, and then we overextend ourselves and have another repeat of 2008?
It doesn't seem like anything is going to stop that from happening. This sort of long-term reason for these crises that seem to be happening more and more often after 1980 are really about inequality, that the money is generated by capitalism, which is incredibly productive, and that money has to be invested somewhere. And because people at the bottom can't buy the things without credit, it gets invested in debt. But eventually the debts come due and people can't pay them. And voila, here's another crisis, whether it's the SNL crisis or today, these things keep happening again and again until we figure out a way to make capitalism work for people at the bottom as well as it does for the top. These crises are going to keep happening. And of course, the good thing as a historian, I like to remind people, is that we did figure this out before. In after World War II, for about 30 years, we managed to balance growth and inequality in the economy, which allowed broad prosperity for most of America.
When we're talking about those people at the bottom you just mentioned, there's a big financial self-help industry telling people how to get out of debt, cut their spending, that sort of thing. Do you think there's something to that, or does there need to be more of a structural solution to their problems?
Well, I think it's good to budget one's income, but there's also, we need to recognize at the sort of structural level that budgets can control us, but they can't control the world we live in. So that even if you're living within your means, if you lose your job, suddenly everything falls apart. And for most people who are living paycheck to paycheck or near to that, no matter how good they are at shopping at the grocery store, they're still going to come up very short if things fall apart. And it's that insecurity of the labor market today that is very difficult for many Americans, that while large corporations can shoulder risk and uncertainty by, you know, buying futures contracts and hedging their risk and such, ordinary folks can't do that. Ordinary folks just want stable lives. And that is a structural problem that we need to address in the economy.
All right, Lewis, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was Lewis Hyman. He's assistant professor at Cornell University, the author of Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. Coming up, we'll find out how to make the most of our upcoming holiday photo sessions and any photographs we take. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Well, it's the holiday season. Families get together, a great time to take pictures, create memories for generations to come. My challenge always, how do you take good photographs? That's where I run into trouble. Our next guest will teach us how to take pictures of what a moment feels like instead of what it looks like. George Lang joins us. He's the author of the new book, The Unforgettable Photograph, 228 Ideas, Tips, and Secrets for Taking the Best Pictures of Your Life. George, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you on this holiday weekend?
Really happy. Really happy.
Great. Well, I just mentioned this idea of taking a picture of what a moment feels like. How do you do that?
One of the ways that I explain it is almost comparing it to a kiss. When you kiss someone, generally your eyes are closed. You're so close, and you open up all your other senses. You're hearing things, you're feeling things, you're tasting things. And my feeling is that you should use all of your senses when you're taking a picture, not just your eyes. And many people now are going around and taking pictures of their desserts. And my challenge is to take pictures of what your desserts taste like, not only what they look like.
I think that's part of my problem. I try to get people posed and standing just right, or really, I'm just looking, and that's it. How do I shake that mindset before we even get into practical tips? How do we fix our brains to think this way?
Well, in many ways, the least interesting picture is the posed picture looking in the camera. Almost everything that happens before that moment and after that moment are more interesting and more revealing. And really what happens is we're all sharing our pictures every day now, and most of the pictures aren't that interesting, but all my friends are really interesting, and all the people that whose pictures I look at are really interesting, and I just feel like there are so many pictures that we aren't taking that we are experiencing. So if we can dip a little bit more into photographing our experiences and the whole story of the experience, like a lot of us are in the middle of a big Thanksgiving Day weekend, and there's a whole story unfolding of people getting packed and traveling and picking them up at the airport and creating these feasts and eating the feasts and, you know, everyone passing out afterwards. All along the way, those are really interesting pictures. And we try and often take pictures that are fake, you know, stand here and smile, rather than all the amazing things going on around that. Even when people are a little less happy, some of those pictures are more revealing, or just so many things going on every day.
One of the tips that you give that I love is don't wait for the smile. Don't make people smile. I hate smiling for pictures, and I'm terrible at it. I can't get my kids to do it. Right. Why please convince everyone else around me that we don't need the smile?
Well, the smile, especially when you're doing a posed picture, is just almost the most artificial thing you can have someone do. So you're going to wind up with the most artificial picture. But my kids even, and they've been photographed. I have a 3- and a 6-year-old boy. They've been photographed every single day of their life.
Wow.
And still, when I pick up the camera, they'll go, cheese. And then, you know, once that moment's over, which is not what I'm interested in, then we get back to doing what we were doing or being who we are. I mean, just this morning, my kids were watching TV at one point, and my wife said, look at them. And they were both in these just beautiful positions on this chair, and they weren't going to pay any attention to me. So I could do whatever I wanted with them. And they were backlit. It was just this beautiful moment. It's the moment that most people never pick up the camera. There's a picture that I took of the beach a couple summers ago of two sisters plucking each other's eyebrows on the porch. You would never pick up the camera to take that. Or they were painting their toenails on the autobiography of Malcolm X, which they were reading for school. And I just photographed their toenails on the book. There are just so many things going on every day. Even before we have breakfast, you know, all the things that are coming together throughout the year. One of the other tips that I talk about a lot is throughout the year, the light changes in our house. And there are certain pockets of light that are just beautiful on the third floor, in the den. And for a couple of weeks or months, the light comes and goes. And if you just pay attention to that light, those are sweet pockets of places to take pictures.
One of your most basic pieces of advice that I think I'll take to heart is that we don't take enough pictures. We line up the shot, we take one, maybe another one for insurance. That's not enough, right?
That kind of depends. I think that a lot of people are actually starting to photograph so much during the experience that they're missing the experience.
Oh.
I feel like, you know, there are lots of times to take pictures, but our life shouldn't be spent only taking pictures. The pictures are artifacts and documents of our lives. There are personal histories. What happened like 3 or 4 years ago is we went from being event photographers. We had our cameras and we would shoot birthdays and vacations and maybe the holidays. And then we got our smartphones and all of our point and shoots became really reasonable. And we started photographing every day and sharing those pictures. But what did that really mean? It was the transition between having a couple of pictures a year or maybe even a couple hundred to having thousands. And within that group of pictures that we can now take, we can really create something very special, both for ourselves and to leave for our future generations.
Are you glad to see this digital photography come along and the phones and the cheaper cameras? And is it kind of liberating to be able to take a lot of pictures and not worry about how much the film is going to cost to develop?
Exactly. I mean, what's so funny is I came up and went to school and started my career in the analog age with film, and I couldn't wait for digital to come along, even though it hadn't been invented yet. And when it came along, I was a very early adapter, and I just find digital photography really freeing, and especially now the cameras need almost no light to shoot. If you can see something, you can photograph it with almost any device now. And that's incredibly liberating. Like pictures that you think, oh, it's too dark, it's no longer too dark. In fact, there's more light there for the camera than even your eye can see.
We're talking to George Lang. His new book is The Unforgettable Photograph, 228 Ideas, Tips, and Secrets for Taking the Best Pictures of Your Life. Coming up, we're going to get into ideas of composition and light, maybe talk equipment a little bit, and we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about how to take a better picture, maybe of your family, maybe this weekend? Or do you have a photography tip you'd like to share? Can you tell us about the best picture you've ever taken in your life and what makes it so good? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. We continue our conversation now with George Lang. He's a photographer. His new book is The Unforgettable Photograph, 228 Ideas, Tips, and Secrets for Taking the Best Pictures of Your Life. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about a kind of picture you need help taking, or you want to tell us about the best picture you have ever taken, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We've got Anthony with us in Watertown. Anthony, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. George, thank you for taking your time to help us.
My pleasure.
One of the things that I've done since the digital camera came out makes it, obviously, like you said, a million times easier for an amateur person like myself to try and take that one photo that we think is, you know, worth taking. One of the things I put on my bucket list was to take 5 or 10 amazing photos. And when I did that, like I said, I'm an amateur. I have no idea about nothing. And I once read an article somewhere that said try to include that a third is like the main object and use that as the center, or not center, but the left or the right or the up or the down, but I'd go with a third of the photo that way. And I took a picture from underneath in San Francisco, from underneath the bridge, the San Francisco Bridge, and it's one of the photos that people have always gone, did you take that? And I beam a little bit with pride when I go, yes, it doesn't look like I could do that, you know? So is, other than that, like, third thing, and one, is that true? Because it seems like some of my pictures have been a lot better since I've taken that notion. And if that is true, is there any other, that one little nugget that will really help me be able to be a better photographer on the shoot?
Thanks for the call, Anthony, and congratulations on that great shot. What do you think, George?
Well, one of the things that he did that was great is he walked underneath the bridge to take the picture rather than straight on. I think whenever you keep moving when you're taking a picture, lots of times we get in one place and our feet are like lead and we never move. And I when I take pictures, try and swoop all around the scene. I'll go behind the people, above them, underneath them. I will have the light really good, and then I'll go to a place where even the light might be playing against all the rules. And I'm just like looking and moving through a scene to find the best picture. So, I mean, one of the best tips I can give is to keep moving. If you can shoot, when you shoot down on something, it's almost always interesting. I'll go back to a picture that I took years ago, and I was having to do a story for House and Garden on people that live in hotel rooms for long periods of time, and it was Carol Channing in Chicago. And I come into her suite, and she's all made up, and she said, I'm going to lie on the ground, and I want you to shoot down on me because that's how my face looks best. And it was crazy, but like looking down on a lot of things really really gives you an angle that's always interesting. So looking up on the bridge was a great idea. Looking down on different things is great, and then looking all around.
you've got a lot of pictures, not surprisingly, in your book at George, and you've got a lot of great examples of this, taking a picture of a kid jumping on a trampoline, and you were lying down, it looks like, underneath the trampoline. It's a great action shot.
And a very dangerous one to shoot. When they jump too close, it gets very close to your lens. You have to be really careful. But one of the things that's interesting with most of the trampolines is that when you look at them, it looks like the surface is opaque. But when you get underneath it, you can see through, and it's a great angle to shoot. But be really careful.
Don't try this at home, necessarily. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Tom with us in Prairie du Chien. Tom, hi.
Hi. We have a friend who's from Japan, and I took him around the area a few years ago. And everywhere we went, he would take numerous photographs and then walk away. And I asked him about it, and he said he was going to look at them later and enjoy the experience. And I wonder your guest's thoughts on the framing the photography versus enjoying the emotion of the moment.
Ah, interesting. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom.
That is so important. I feel like so many places that I go now, especially if you go to concerts, people are taking pictures the whole time and texting them and sharing them all through the show, which is not only annoying to the people around you, you're missing the whole experience. And my feeling is with so many things that we do, like take your pictures and take them quickly and put away your phone or put away your camera and look at them later, two things will happen. One is the pictures that you share, you'll have time to pick out the best ones rather than whatever's the first picture that comes up, and you'll be sharing better pictures. And the second is that you'll enjoy the experience and have the human experience of the music or the sports event or whatever you're doing.
All right, let's get to some more of the practical suggestions, George. You've got a whole chapter on playing with the use of light. Can you give us a couple ideas on how to use light, maybe in exciting ways, to get a different kind of picture?
There are really no rules for the way that you should use light. It's just really appreciating the light. A lot of the tips in the book are about appreciating things around you. You are the people around you, the experience that you're having every day, even mundane things like cooking. You know, we're all cooking every day, and there are interesting parts of that that are just that capture things that are going on. With light, what you want to do, though, is I shoot almost all available light, but I'll use everything from flashlights, you know, that are around the house, you know, non-professional equipment. I never use the flash on my camera. If I'm doing a job, I might do big strobe lights, but I never use an on-camera flash. I just think it's the least flattering and least interesting that you can use. But if you have lamps that are on, if you have light bouncing around your house and just kind of appreciate it, sometimes you'll go in the street, certainly in a big city, and the lights bouncing off windows onto the street, making these very abstract patterns that are just beautiful to shoot with.
Well, it seems like part of the goal is not so much creating the right light as having an eye for an interesting light that is already there.
Exactly, exactly.
All right. Well, a lot of people may be wondering about equipment. Do they need to get fancy stuff? Can you give us a quick cardinal rule for maybe a lower budget photographer who just wants a camera they could take some decent pictures with?
Right. All the cameras on the market today are incredible. I mean, even compared to 5 years ago, the cheapest camera on the market can blow away anything that's been around. So it's really kind of getting in your comfort zone of how much you want to be adjusting it, how much if you want interchangeable lenses. The cameras on our phone are really remarkable, and you can take fantastic pictures with those. Or if you want to step up and get into some of the interchangeable lenses and the bigger cameras, that's great too. I feel that all the tips in the book can also help you take great mental pictures. I love the idea that we're like seeing things, and if we have a camera and can take it, it's great. But the idea of appreciating the light and appreciating the moment is 3/4 of the way there to getting a great photograph.
I love that. So think like a photographer, even if there's not a camera in sight. In
exactly.
All right. Well, and one of the things I love about the book is, you know, I take pictures and they're on my computer and I'm done with them then, I guess. But you have a lot of fun ideas on what to do with the pictures and how to display them. Could you share a few of those?
Those are mostly from my wife Stephanie, who's an artist and is just really resourceful. Most of the ideas in the book are things that she found at antique stores or people would throw out. Everything from using clothespins and making lines of pictures going around to framing pictures and putting them in odd places of the house. The last house that we were in had a very tall stairway, and up at the very top, she put two framed pictures of people diving off a diving board. So so when you saw it from the third floor or up from the bottom, you would see that. You can do a lot of things for almost no money, displaying the pictures and sharing them now too.
And there's one, I can't find it right now, but there's one where I think maybe it was your wife found a cute-looking box maybe at a thrift store, and just having, I'm not a big fan of having tchotchkes around the house, but this one I might do, having a little box with a handful of photos in it, and it's sitting there, and if somebody could, you know, sort through them and put them back when they're done. That's a great way to display them.
It's so much fun. I mean, that was just an old box that she found, and you can either print them on your computer printer because they're so little that the quality is going to be fine, or all of the print services online. The prints are now like under a dime a piece. You know, it's just so reasonable. And especially our kids just love looking at the pictures of them as real pictures, not just scrolling on your – I mean, they love looking at our phones and looking on the computer, but to have the actual pictures and be able to spread them out and not to treat them too precious, but – you know, have this box that they can play with is really fun.
One last question, one last bit of advice I want to get into is, you know, we're talking about taking non-posed pictures in some cases, capturing moments. My problem is I have a lot of pictures of moments where the person's, you know, halfway out of the frame or on the soccer field, my kids, I might get their ankle if I'm lucky. How do you get those candid moments where people are moving around and yet still get a meaningful picture of somebody?
Well, two things there. One is there's a certain rhythm to all of our lives. There's a certain rhythm to the way that we get up and the way that we get ready and the way that we walk down the street or hike or bicycle or whatever we do. And if you get into that rhythm and appreciate that rhythm and feel that rhythm, you can oftentimes photograph at that same rhythm too. If you're walking with someone and you're walking at the same pace, the photograph that you take will not be of that awkward moment where someone's kind of in between a step because you're both in step. So if you can coordinate that, that works out great. And the other thing is when you crop a picture, it's okay if it's not perfectly cropped. Like this idea that the perfect crop is the person right in the middle of the frame. Mm. There's a picture in the book of one of my sons crying. And, you know, I don't think we should pick up the camera every time our children cry, however, or each other. Those pictures are really powerful. And the picture that I took is cropped very tightly and very odd, but it feels more dynamic. So sometimes when you're photographing different things, that being out of the frame or their head cut off or just showing parts of their body is actually a more powerful photograph than getting the whole thing.
All right,
and
George.
When you are photographing your son at soccer, you have to take a lot of pictures.
That's true. George, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's George Lang, his new book, The Unforgettable Photograph, 228 Ideas, Tips, and Secrets for Taking the Best Pictures of Your Life. Coming up, a weekly roundup of our state news with Michael Leland. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an amazing story from American history of Sioux leader Red Cloud and the wars between his people and the United States government in the years after the Civil War. First, it's time for our weekly check-in on the top news from around Wisconsin. WPR News Director Michael Leland joins us for today's roundup. Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Happy to be here.
So first, some economic news. The state legislature doesn't really have a hand in this one. A lot of people are out shopping today.
Yeah, perhaps you've heard. It's something called Black Friday.
I have heard of that now you mention it.
Yeah, this is the biggest shopping day of the year. It traditionally had been sort of the day when the retailers are hoping to get into the black for the year by getting a lot of people in the doors. In Wisconsin, like in a lot of other places, Black Friday actually got underway yesterday with big retailers like Target and Walmart and Shopko and Kohl's opening last night. instead of waiting till today. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a lot of protesting about that on social media, but Walmart, for example, had said that throughout the country it had more than 10 million registered transactions last night, so apparently there were some people looking to shop on Thanksgiving Day.
I guess so. Yeah, we talked some about the protest yesterday. Well, one thing people are looking at with Black Friday and the shopping season is kind of as an economic indicator. What's the state looking at this year?
Exactly. Well, the outlook for Wisconsin, it might be good. The Department of Workforce Development has said that Wisconsin stores have been hiring more people for this holiday season compared to last year, and that could mean that they're expecting business to be better. And you can also assume to some extent that more people working will mean that more people are having some money to spend in the stores themselves.
Mm. Now, Thanksgiving was late this year, and I've heard some rumblings of people saying shorter shopping season means a worse shopping season?
Possibly. You know, in a way, yeah, you basically are making this 6 days shorter of a shopping season this year than had been the case last year. So it's hard to say what could happen, especially if we're hit by bad weather. Last year, you may remember, there was a big snowstorm about a week before Christmas. That sort of thing can knock out sales. Not so much online, because, well, if it's snowing out, you can still shop at home. But it could hurt local stores that depend on customers walking through their doors. So really, the weather plays an even more critical role in this shorter shopping season, because presumably there's less time to make up for it if any of the big days are knocked out.
Speaking of local stores, the big box stores celebrate Black Friday. The online people have, Cyber Monday, right? Tomorrow, though, there's another event.
Yeah, another one. This was something that started in recent years called Small Business Saturday. It's just independent, locally owned stores urging people to think about spending at least some of their holiday dollars at locally based stores. Support your local store owners, who are often the people who may sponsor your Little League team or whatnot. And proponents of this say that it also helps the local economy, because it keeps more money in the local community compared to money that would be spent at some of the larger stores.
Speaking of shopping, here's something that's probably not on everyone's shopping list. An island. We've been reporting on somebody buying an island. What happened there?
Who wouldn't want to buy an island for Christmas? Actually, this is the Nature Conservancy has purchased an island, probably an island that most of us will never see. It's called St. Martin Island. It's actually in Michigan waters. It's if you follow Door County to Washington Island and Rock County and keep going, you'll eventually get to St. Martin Island. It's been mostly owned by a man named Fred Luber and his family. They're from Milwaukee. He's a former chairman and CEO of Super Steel Products. He bought it back in the 80s, thinking he'd develop it as a resort, but that never really panned out. And over the years, the family's been feeling that it's an environmentally special place that should be preserved, and now they're selling it.
So the Nature Conservancy obviously agrees that it's a place that should be preserved. Mm-hmm. What have they done, and what's their plan for it?
Well, they've bought 94% of the island from the Luber family. That's the percentage of the island that he owned. And it says that the island's important as a stopping point for migrating birds. More than 100 species of birds have used that island in recent years. The Conservancy eventually is going to turn over its share of the island to the National Fish and Wildlife Service, and then it'll be added to the Green Bay National Wildlife Refuge.
And there were no plans, as you said, for the family to develop it in any other way?
Yeah, largely because there's no electricity or other, you know, really resources on the island, you know, like electricity, running water, that sort of thing. And it's pretty remote. It's not something that most of us could easily get to. So there is no big development planned on the island. Chuck Kornbach of WPR reported this week that that sort of thing makes it a good time to make a deal for conservation when there's not a lot of other parties bidding on it. So the Conservancy is paying about $1.5 million for the island, which, by the way, is well below the fair market value of $4.35 million. But again, the family wanted to keep it preserved, so I'm sure that played largely into the final price for the island.
Well, that would be a pretty good Black Friday deal, though they jumped ahead
Absolutely.
Of Black Friday.
Absolutely, all islands 70% off.
I've got to get my own island quick. Well, and then looking ahead to next week, now the legislature finished its session, but now they're coming back.
Right. They're coming back, back in session beginning Monday. They're going to consider Governor Walker's request that they delay the state's plan to move more than 70,000 people off of Medicaid and onto the federal health insurance marketplace. Now, that coverage for people, these are people who are above the poverty line, was to end January 1st. And to have that coverage in place, though, you had to sign up for it by December 15th, which is just a little more than 2 weeks away. Mm-hmm. Problem is, as we've all heard, the federal government's healthcare.gov website, where people in Wisconsin will go to enroll for this private coverage, got off to a rough start. Only about 900 people in the state could sign up for the coverage in the first month or so. So the proposal now is to move that coverage to the end of March instead of the end of December.
The idea then that people would have more time, the website would have more time to get up and running, and then people would be able to sign up for it and not have an interruption in coverage.
Exactly, exactly.
That's got a ripple effect, though. Some people who previously, and this I'll admit I get a bit confused on, some people who weren't previously covered under BadgerCare, mm-hmm. right, would have gone on. Who are they and what happens to them now?
Okay, there are about another 80,000 or so people. They are childless adults who right now don't qualify for Medicaid, which is BadgerCare in Wisconsin. They are below the poverty line. The state had planned to move them into BadgerCare once this other group was moved onto the federal exchange. Now it's going to delay that moving until the end of March. So it will delay moving these childless adults without coverage onto BadgerCare. And a report this week from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau said because of all of this, the state is actually going to end up saving about $23 million from this three-month delay.
And Governor Walker had asked for this special session. I believe legislative leaders in the Republican Party are agreeing with his goals here. Any response from Democrats looking for any changes or permutations to this plan?
Well, at least one Democrat says he wants to challenge this plan. It's Tim Cullen, a state senator from Janesville, says he wants to amend the governor's proposal and allow the state to accept federal money that's available to provide coverage for both of these groups, the people who are to be moved off of BadgerCare and the people who are to move onto BadgerCare to cover them for the next 3 months. The governor's office and some Republican leaders are already saying that they don't support that proposal, though.
So that probably isn't going to happen. It's a Republican-controlled legislature in both houses. Mm-hmm. Republicans control the governor's office, obviously. Probably not going to happen.
There'll be discussion about it, but it would be difficult unless he can get a number of Republicans to support it for it to go anywhere.
All right. What's the timeline for this next week?
Well, the bill goes up to the Joint Finance Committee on Monday. The Assembly has already put it on the schedule to take up this bill on Wednesday. The Senate hasn't set a date to consider the bill yet, but it is expected to consider it sometime in December.
Well, you'll be covering that in the news department. We'll be covering it here on Central Time mm-hmm. as well. One thing I wanted to get to before we let you go, Michael, you're known around Wisconsin Public Radio as the resident pie maestro. You make amazing pies. Mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to try some. What was on your dessert menu on Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving is one of those holidays of the year that despite the fact that so many people make a pie, I don't make pies for Thanksgiving. I don't know why. It just has worked out that
trend.
Way. I reject the trend. I'm saving myself for Pie Day next year. Mm-hmm. No, this year I found a recipe for a gingerbread that's made with pumpkin and Guinness stout. And
wow.
It's got a great cream cheese frosting. And I tried it this year. And I liked it, and given from the empty plate in the break room, I think members of the staff liked it as well.
Well, they all got to it before I did, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah.
All right, Michael, thanks so much, as always.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland and Pie Maestro Michael Leland. We check in this time each week on the top stories in Wisconsin politics and beyond. Coming up, a biography tells the forgotten story of an American legend, the Sioux leader Red Cloud. We'll talk to a co-author of the book. That's coming up after the news. They have some amazing stories about a war after the U.S. Civil War between the United States, the Sioux led by Red Cloud, and their allies. We'll be back on Monday here on Central Time. We've got a book, The Who's Who in the Bible. If you are a Christian or a non-Christian who just wants to keep up with all the cultural references in the Bible, it'll be an interesting interview. Stick around. More to come here today on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.